Blog Talk Radio. It's time for Monday Night Radio. Monday night is your night to talk with the experts. Call us now to get into the queue at 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6. Call us now or email your questions and comments to comments@mondaynightradio.com or tweet them to us at Monday Radio. And now, here's your host, Ann P. Mitchell, Esquire. Good evening and welcome to another episode of Blog Talk Monday Night Radio. And we are so very, very honored tonight to have a very special guest with us. We have with us Mr. Arun Gandhi. He is the grandson of Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi, but he's also doing many wonderful things in his own right, and we are going to bring him on in just a moment to tell us about those things. First, I would like to just remind you that next week we have with us an expert on workplace issues. So if you are an employee experiencing problems at work or an employer wanting to boost morale in the workplace, the next week's show is for you. Our guest will be Linda Barbachia, and she's going to tell you how to handle those workplace issues and how you can change going to work where you work from dreaded to enjoyable. That's next week's show, but now let's turn our attention to this week's show. And it is my great, great pleasure to welcome as our guest, Mr. Arun Gandhi. Mr. Gandhi, are you there?
Yes, I am here. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Oh, Mr. Gandhi, it is such a pleasure and a privilege to have you on our show. We are so very glad to have you here with us. And
thank you.
One of the things we're going to talk about is your grandfather had a saying that people around the world are familiar with, be the change. But we're also going to talk about how individuals can make a difference. And I'd like to just tell our listeners a little bit about how you, as an individual, along with your late wife, made a difference. Because you spent, I believe, almost 30 years working with children to help abandoned and impoverished children, helping to lift them out of poverty, to help orphans find homes. And you have really put that to work, making a change with your own work, right?
Yes, indeed. You know, we were living in India, and at that time, we found many babies that were abandoned soon after birth because they were born to unwed mothers. And in the Indian culture, it's a stigma for a woman to have a baby before marriage. So we found these babies and found them homes, and many of them are now in Sweden and in other countries, as well as many in India too. In all, we have rescued and found homes for about 128 children.
That's incredible. 128 babies and children that now have better lives directly because of you and your wife's work. Are you in touch with any of them still? Do you know where they are now and what they're doing?
Yes, I am in touch with many of them. Many, as I said, are in Sweden, and some are in India, and there's one in France. And I keep in touch with them as much as possible. And it's become a little easier now with Facebook. Many of them are on my friends on Facebook, so we write to each other and keep in touch. For them, I am their grandfather now.
That's lovely to have 128 grandchildren. That's pretty impressive.
Right.
You're listening to Monday Night Radio. Our guest is Arun Gandhi, and you can call in to speak with Mr. Gandhi and give him your comments and questions at our toll-free number, 866-MONDAY-6. You can also email any comments or questions you have to our email hotline at comments at MondayNightRadio.com. You can send us a message on Facebook at Monday Night Radio, on Twitter at Monday Radio, and also on AOL Instant Messenger at Monday Night Radio. Now, Mr. Gandhi, you turned this passion for helping children into an organization, and we would love to hear a bit about your Gandhi for Children Foundation, which visitors can go to at gandhiforchildren.org.
Yes, this happened in 2007 when my wife passed away after a brief illness, and my son and my daughter asked me if we could not commemorate her memory by building a school for in her memory. And so I said yes, and I came back to the United States and spoke with a lot of friends of mine, and they all were very keen to join in and do whatever they could. So very soon, within a matter of a few weeks, I was able to collect about $50,000. And that was invested in starting the Gandhi Worldwide Education Institute for impoverished children. And then my friend said that this is such a wonderful concept. Now why don't we make it a worldwide issue instead of just one school? We will have many schools. And so we have a very ambitious program of creating many schools for underprivileged children everywhere in the world. But the first model school is going to come up in India in a small village. If that succeeds, then and if we are able to raise enough money, we will build more schools elsewhere.
And do you have any particular model for these schools or requirements in terms of who may attend? How are you doing the greatest outreach you can through each school?
Well, yes, the requirement is that we are going to try to follow the model that my grandfather had talked about and written about, and that is to help people more through vocational training rather than the conventional education program. Mm-hmm. The conventional education program is so city-based that people living out in the villages, if they get that kind of education, they would have to come into the city to find employment. And that defeats the purpose, because people should be able to find work where they live rather than have to uproot themselves from there and go hundreds of miles away to the nearest city to find a job there. And so what we are going to do is give them that kind of education that Gandhi talked about, and also that instead of taking one child from a family and giving that child education, we are going to try to raise the whole family out of poverty. Now, this is really an ambitious thing because nobody has ever tried to work with the entire family. They usually have schools and just one child or two children from a family are able to go there. And since our children are going to be the most impoverished, people who are not going to be able to pay fees or anything like that, we're going to have to raise a lot of money to run this school. We already have one that is running. It's in a rented premises, and because the place is very small, we have restricted the number of students. Right now, we have about 45, they are residential there. And then we have started satellite classes under trees and in shanties in slum areas, where these children from that area are collected together and given some education by volunteer teachers. So So this kind of program has been going on for about last three, four years. And once we have the campus built, then we will have about 300 children, and it will be more organized.
So your concept then is that by educating the children, you will also help to lift their parents and extended family out of poverty, but not only that, but the future generations to come, so their children and their children's children.
Yes. Yes, that is the plan, and we hope that it will succeed.
So isn't this then, and please forgive me for being presumptuous with understanding these terms, but isn't that sort of the ultimate way to carry on your grandfather's idea of Sarvodaya? Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are, and that's what he wanted. You know, he wanted a Sarvodaya society where everybody benefits from it and everybody is able to live a decent life. Unfortunately, today in the modern times, we have adopted the materialistic kind of lifestyle in every country. And so everybody is very selfish, and the powerful grab as much of the pie as possible, and very little of that goes down to the poor people. And so we have a tremendous imbalance in the world where some people live a very affluent lifestyle and other people live a very impoverished lifestyle.
Could you talk a little bit, because this reminds me also of Satyagraha, which I understand means the pursuit of truth, but also had its roots in your grandfather's desire to let everyone have access and have these potentials. And could you talk a little bit about that and explain that for us?
Yes, Satyagraha was also a part of his philosophy of nonviolence. And since he used it mainly for the freedom of India, many people came to believe that Satyagraha is only a political tool to be used for political conflicts. But in fact, it's not just a political tool, it is a philosophy of life, because he said that life itself is a pursuit of truth. And we are constantly trying to seek truth, we are constantly trying to find the meaning of life. We are constantly trying to find salvation for ourselves. And all of these things are searching for truth, the truth of life. And that needs to be done more with greater commitment and with a greater desire. And then we would be able to find some answers to the questions that face us all the time.
You're listening to Monday Night Radio with our guest Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi. And you can dial in and give us your comments and questions at 866-MONDAY-6 or send us a message via AOL Instant Messenger at Monday Night Radio or Facebook at Monday Night Radio or on Twitter at Monday Radio. Mr. Gandhi, we have some people who've called in, and some of them are working themselves on making a difference and being the change. But first, could you tell us a little bit about that, the philosophy of Be the Change, and how individuals really can make a difference? And certainly while your grandfather was a supreme example of that, you also are certainly an individual making a huge difference in the lives of many, many children. And could you talk a little bit about how individuals really can make a difference? I think we're very demoralized these days, and I think people really don't feel like they can make a difference on their own, but they can.
Yes, I think firstly we need to understand that no individual can change the whole world, and so we should not aspire to change the world. I think much of the problem that faces people who are working in social field is that they desire to change the world and have a very big ambition. And since they cannot, reach that ambition, they give up and burn out and then think that it's all a waste of time. But if we set ourselves goals that are attainable and then attain those goals and set other goals, then, we would have more encouragement and determination to continue working there. And so I think it's very important for us to remember this and to set goals that we can attain. Now, what we have done and what I have understood from Grandfather's philosophy, I learned from him at the age of 12. Not that it made a lot of sense to me at that age. I wasn't a very bright student at the time, but he had a knack of teaching, which was a very powerful tool, and that lesson kind of stuck in my mind. And as I grew up, I began to reflect on it, and I thought it was a wonderful, life-changing experience for me. Now, first lesson that I want to share with you, and which explains his very famous quotation, "To be the change." He told me that we commit a lot of passive violence or non-physical violence all the time, and that is something that we need to be concerned about. And he said that the only way we can find out how much of this passive violence we commit is by making an introspection. And what he did with me at that time was he made me draw a genealogical tree of violence on the same principles as a family tree, with violence mm-hmm. as the grandparent and physical violence and passive violence as the two branches. And every day before I went to bed, I had to analyze and examine everything that I had experienced during the day and put them down on that tree.
Wow.
Now, if it's the kind of violence where physical force is used, like wars and killings and beatings and murders and rapes and fighting and punching and all of these things where physical force is used, would go under physical violence. But if it's the kind of violence where we don't use any physical force and yet we hurt people, directly or indirectly, consciously or unconsciously, and that would be things like discrimination, oppression, suppression, economic, political, social, cultural, religious, all these little things that we do every day, which are very hurtful. And, that kind of thing would go under passive violence. And when I began to do this introspection, within a few months, I was able to fill up a whole wall in my room with acts of passive violence. And that is when Grandfather explained to me the connection between the two. He said, we commit passive violence all the time, every day, consciously and unconsciously, and that generates anger in the victim. And the victim then resorts to physical violence to get justice. So it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence. So logically, if we want to put out that fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And since the fuel supply comes from each one of us, we have to become the change that we wish to see in the world. So I would suggest for everybody in this, all your listeners and everybody else in this world, we need to do that introspection. And we need to find out how are we committing violence, either passive or physical violence, and what can we do to change our attitudes and our behaviors and our relationships so that we don't commit this kind of violence and provide the fuel that ignites the violence, all the physical violence all the time.
That is an incredibly profound lesson. And thank you for sharing that very personal story with us. That's
Wow. It's a very profound thing, and I just hope and wish that people would take it to heart and make a difference in life. Because, you know, we seem to think that life is about going around in circles from birth to death, and that, we have nothing else to do but just wait for death. And in the meantime, we amass wealth. And, there's a lot more purpose to life than just making money and passing the time of day. Grandfather said that life is about climbing a ladder. We are constantly going upwards, and to be able to do justice to that, and to be able to become better human beings, we must make a conscious effort every day that we are going up one rung of that ladder, and today we are going to be better human beings than we were yesterday. And if we make that conscious effort and continue to do that every day, then we will be better human beings and be able to achieve as much as he did in his life.
You're listening to Monday Night Radio. Our guest is Arun Gandhi, and you can mail in your questions and comments for Mr. Gandhi at comments@mondaynightradio.com, or you can send us a message via AOL Instant Messenger to Monday Night Radio, or at Facebook / Monday Night Radio, or via Twitter at Monday Radio. I want to bring on a caller now, Mr. Gandhi, because I think that she will very much have been able to relate to what you were talking about, perhaps with passive violence, and I don't know, maybe even direct, I don't know. But let's bring in Ellie, calling from Las Vegas. Ellie, good evening. Are you there?
Yes, I am. And Elle Swan. Yes, I am there.
I'm sorry. I thought Ellie. I apologize. It's Elle.
No,
this is Elle Swan.
Yes.
And, you're on the air with Anne and with Mr. Gandhi.
Yes, and I'm very excited, and you were absolutely right. The passive violence, it just hit me in my core. And Mr. Gandhi, I do a newsletter. It's called Be Fit, Live Rich, and I also am a motivational speaker, an international speaker, and a life coach who is dedicated to helping people understand that the violence against ourselves, specifically with drug addiction, alcohol addiction, addiction to food, et cetera, especially prescription drugs in America, it's rampant now. 7 out of 10 of Americans are overweight. My backstory, very briefly, is 10 years ago, I lived on the streets. I was a college graduate with an Ivy League education. And during the course of 5 years, I spiraled in depression to use drugs, and I ended up living on the streets. My family didn't know if I was alive or dead. And I overdosed in an abandoned van, and I had a spiritual awakening as I was overdosing and dying. And from that, I realized that I had been making the choice to take my hatred, take my disappointment with life in general, from what happened as a child or just what was happening in the world, and I turned it against myself. And in that moment, I made a decision, or actually God showed me, that I could choose to love myself. And what is underneath, as you said, with the passive violence, what's underneath the addiction, the rampant addiction, is self-hatred, which is absolutely, based on what you just said, passive violence. And so as we learn to love ourselves and live without the crutches of cigarettes, of drugs, of alcohol, because the prescription medication, for example, it just suppresses the hatred. It suppresses it.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir. So I'm very excited to be on this call with you tonight.
No, I agree with you. I think, this is a waste of life when slowly die with all these addictions and nobody benefits from it. And, there's just a waste of a good life.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish people wouldn't get into those addictions and waste their life, because life is too precious to be wasted.
It is. It is. And the model for my newsletter and all the work I do is, I love what you said about climbing the ladder. It's rise above mediocrity. If we could just rise, if we could make a commitment, like you said, on a daily basis to be better today than we were yesterday, we inch by inch, day by day, rise above mediocrity. And when we do that, everyone is operating at a higher vibration. So I don't want to take much time. If for other people that are listening that want to collaborate, my website is www.ellesswan.com. Thank you very much for your time.
Elle, thank you for the call.
You
very much. That's a very interesting aspect that I had not really thought about, and that is the sort of the self-violence and how that perpetuates in a ripple effect to others as well and to your families. And I think maybe even more so here, I'm not so sure, but certainly here in America, the concept of loving yourself even now is, you know, people say it all the time, but I think many people don't get it. And just the concept.
Well, the thing is, you know, the thing is what happens here in the United States and now increasingly in other countries also is that we mouth the words. We just, you know, we tell ourselves and tell each other, we love you. But it doesn't really reflect in our actions or in our behavior. It's just an kind of empty words that we say, and that doesn't have any effect at all. You know, I see this all the time when parents and spouses are constantly telling each other, "I love you, I love you," and really they don't even mean it. Sometimes they just mouth the words. And, you know, now people have come to realize that there's really no meaning in this word, and so they don't believe anything. And that's what really adds up to the frustrations, and people get into addictions and all that. You know, my wife and I lived on a university campus for many years when she was alive, and she was a tremendous mother figure. She loved to mother everybody there. And she used to gather all these students and invite them to come and join us for lunch and in our office. And, you know, every day we would have about 6, 8, 10 students with their packed lunches would come and sit with us and we would chat and eat. And she would mother them. And many of them cried to her and said, "You are nobody to us, and yet you are so considerate and thinking about us and showing this love and affection and all that. And we don't get that in our own homes. Nobody has time for us or for any of these niceties." And that's a very sad situation, you know, when children themselves realize that their parents don't have any time for them. I think that's, you know, worst thing that can happen. I tell parents these days very openly, if you don't have time for your children, don't have children. You have no business to give birth to children and bring them into this world and then leave them to the four winds to raise themselves up.
Well, we have evolved. And I'm sure I'm going to get all kinds of letters about this for saying it, but we have evolved, at least in the United States, a very selfish society. And I, in my previous professional life as an attorney for fathers and children, I saw exactly what you're talking about all the time. Children are just warehoused and sort of sat in front of the television and, you know, there's, you know, two income families and the kids are latchkey kids and it's just, it's so sad. And yet we have
very
managed.
Sad.
We've managed to convince ourselves
traveling.
It's okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And do you see this elsewhere as much as
I do
as
a
well?
Lot of traveling. Sorry?
Do you see, in your travels, do you see this
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, I see this all the time because, you know, at the airports, you see little kids traveling alone from one parent to another parent going on a visit. And sometimes they're escorted by the flight attendants, and sometimes they're just traveling on their own. And it's such a painful sight to see these kids, living with that pain and agony inside them. And so they bury themselves with, the music, and they live in their own world, and they don't know what's going on around them. It's a sad plight that they face. And you said about the society becoming very selfish, but that is the result of a materialistic society. Materialism develops selfishness in people. You know, when we foster this kind of selfishness, when we tell our children that when they are growing up that they have to be successful in life and reach the top and get there by any means possible, all that is instilling the first or sowing the first seeds of selfishness. And success in modern times has come to mean possessions and property. What do you possess? How much do you own? What do you drive? That is the measure of success.
How would your grandfather have defined success?
He would have defined success by what the person has been able to contribute to society. How has he enriched the society in which he or she lives? And in what way has their life been meaningful to other people? Not for themselves, but for others.
Oh, and on that note, let's go to another caller. I think this caller would certainly agree with you. Let's get Jeff, who's calling from Australia, on the line. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure listening in. It's quite an interesting conversation, for sure.
Well, you're on the air now with me and with Mr. Gandhi.
I'm the CEO and founder of a company called SoCo Games, and how we've kind of been applied that philosophy of being part of the change is right from day one, we've tried to figure out a way that we could be a part of the change. And the only way that we could really do it was to keep it real simple. So what we've done in our games is we've built in a mechanism that automatically extracts a percentage of revenue and applies it to what we call the SoCo Games Players Fund. And that Players Fund, based on the votes of our players, now supports 31 charities around the planet. We've tried to take into account every continent except for the really icy one, because that's where our players are. So what in your discussion, the one part that the people I meet and the people who play our games, I don't find them apathetic. I don't think that they really want to be like they are. It's just, it's really tough for the everyday person to find a means that fits into their family life, their work life, their just their lives, and so that they can make a difference. And what we're really happy about is providing them a mechanism where they don't have to do anything but to play a little game for about 15 minutes every once in a while, and we take care of the rest. And through the Players Fund, they can feel good about also being part of something. And we're not tapping into an already depleted bunch of resources, whether it's time or finance. The question I'd like to ask Mr. Gandhi is, one of the hardest things for me in setting all this up was picking the charities. I went to probably 200-300. I researched, I tried to figure them out. And even to this day, like every day I get somebody asking me, can you add us to your Players Fund? In your in your travels, how do you deal with that guilt of saying no to one person and then helping out another? Because, you know, everybody's got finite resources. You'd love to save everybody, but you know, every once in a while a child gets left behind, and that it's something that scares me as we continue to grow and the Players Fund continues to grow. That guilt is starting to be real in me, and it scares me that it'll get to a point where it's actually not fun anymore.
Well, you know, this is a difficult thing, and as I said earlier, we cannot set ourselves goals that we cannot attain. Now, we would love to help all the children of the world who are needy and who are, you know, who need any help. But I know that I don't have that capacity, and really nobody has that capacity to deal with so many millions and millions of children who are languishing in the world today. But that doesn't mean that we don't help those whom we can. And so we have to take that, although it is very painful, and, you know, decision that we can do this much and we will do it and make a difference in the lives of few. The only thing that we can do is to inspire others to continue to do what we have been doing and enlarge the sphere. And then we will be able to help more children there. So, you know, it's just getting other people motivated to do the same thing. You know, many years ago, I found there were lots of people living on the sidewalks in Bombay City, and they had no homes, no shelters, no clothes, no food, very little work, and they were really in a miserable state of affairs. And this was because the government in India had focused much of the development activities in the cities and neglected the rural areas. So six of my friends and I got together and we decided to use Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence to help rebuild these people's self-respect and self-confidence and make them realize that they could do things for themselves. What we did was we rounded up about 500-600 people, and we sat with them and talked with them, and we told them that this is what we are planning to do, and they would have to be a part of the solution because they are a part of the problem. And they were willing to do whatever we asked them because they were so desperate. And so we told them, okay, we want you to create a fund to so that with that money we can create an economic base for you. Now, ordinarily, we would have, you know, one would have expected us to go to a rich person and go and get the money and create this economic base for them and hand it over to them. Now, that would cripple them much more. That would make them believe that we can ask for whatever we want and these people will provide it for us. And that is not what we wanted them to feel, and that is not what Gandhi's philosophy is about. Gandhi's philosophy is about rebuilding the self-respect and self-confidence of the individual so that they can stand on their own feet and not have to depend on anybody for it. So with this, you know, challenge that we threw to them, that you save a coin every day, we don't care how you do it, you work extra hours or you deny yourself something or whatever it is, you collectively, all of you together, save a coin every day and make this fund. And they surprised us when they came back about 2 years later with the equivalent of $11,000.
Wow.
They all saved together. And with that money, we bought them 10 secondhand textile machines and installed those machines in a little tin shed in their hometown, in their village, and sent back about 75, 80 of them to run this factory round the clock so that they could make it possible for all the people who had contributed to this fund to come and live on the profits of that factory. And they did this. And, you know, of course, they didn't know at the time how to manage money, how to plan productions and marketing and all of these things. They had no idea about this. We had to train them and spend a lot of time training them and teaching them. And once they became confident, we handed over charge to them. And I'm shocked that today, and this program began in 1970, and today that program has six factories with more than 1,000 machines, and they have their own cooperative bank, and they just changed their lives completely. And, you know, we also taught them that just as we came there to help them attain a better standard of living, they must now help other people to attain that standard of living too and not become greedy. So, you know, these are the kinds of programs that we can do, and they can multiply, and then, you know, eventually we can be able to solve the problems of the world. But if we get frustrated or if we feel guilty and give up on it, then we are not doing the right thing.
I don't think I'll ever give up, that's for sure. I love that philosophy. And I think the social giving philosophy, from what I can see, is moving in that direction. There's a lot more emphasis on things like building school, providing education, and something I really like is the emergence of the microfinancing organizations like Kiva that, you know, help individuals learn to help themselves and become economically stable instead of just giving them money to survive for a week or two. I love that philosophy.
Right.
I often tell
You know, Gandhi used to say that charity takes place in two forms. There is the charity that is motivated by pity and charity that is motivated by compassion. And the difference here is that when we go out into the streets and we see a hungry person, our immediate reaction is to dip our hands in the pocket, give that person a couple of dollars and tell them to go and buy some food. What we are basically telling them is, you know, get out of my face. I hope I don't never see you again. Take this money and go and buy something and just disappear from here. By that kind of charity, what we are doing is making that person dependent on the charity. We are not concerned whether that person buys food or he goes and buys cigarettes or drugs or alcohol or whatever. And we feel that we just did our good deed for the day and we walk away from there. And yet that deed of ours has not done any good. It has done something very bad. So we have to be more conscious of what we do and how we do it. And if we were to work out of compassion, then we would stop to find out why are these people incapable of taking care of themselves, or you know, what's wrong with them and what are their strengths and what are their potentials that we can exploit so that they can stand on their own feet and achieve things. So it's very essential that we understand charity in the right sense and do it in the right way too.
Jeff, thank you so much for the call. We do need to move on, but before we go, is your game an online game? And if so, would you like to give out the web address for it?
Okay, you can access the game. It's on Facebook, and you can search for it. It's called Earth 2.0, or you can simply go to www.socogames.com, so socogames.com, and there is a link. It'll also tell you about the SoCo Games Players Fund. So right now, in the last month, we went from about 1,000 players and I haven't checked in the last hour, but we're probably about 65,000 players. And through the fund, we're hopefully going to do a lot of good on behalf of everybody. Mr. Gandhi, I love the idea of your school. I'm going to look you up, and perhaps we'll add you, if we can afford it, to our list.
Oh, that, and that's GandhiForChildren.org. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah.
That's really such a wonderful way. I think that, you know, imagine if other people running businesses, you know, as the internet is such an incredible resource to connect so many people at once. And the way that Jeff is doing this with his game is just such a wonderful idea, because it's painless for the people playing, and yet they're really being part of affecting change.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Wonderful thing.
Now,
technology has really made things much easier now.
I'm wondering if you have any special sort of fond memories of time with your grandfather that, if they're not too personal, you might be willing to share with us.
No, I always share them wherever I go and speak there, but yeah, you know, one memory is the lesson that he taught me about violence and nonviolence and the importance of doing introspection. I think that's a very important lesson for everybody to learn. But I think also a very important lesson was about anger management and understanding anger. You know, we don't speak about this. We don't teach anybody how to deal with their anger, and the result of that is that everybody ends up abusing their anger and causing death and destruction. And grandfather taught me, because I grew up in South Africa at a time when apartheid was at its worst, and there was so much hate going around that at one point I thought that there was no love in this world at all. It was just full of hate. And I was beaten up at the age of 10 by some white youths, and then I was beaten up by some black youths both the times, because they didn't like the color of my skin. And I was so angry that I wanted eye for an eye revenge. And it became an obsession with me, and I started doing exercises and pumping iron so that I could become strong and be able to fight back again. And that's when my parents took me to India, and I had the opportunity to live with grandfather. And the first lesson that he taught me was about understanding that anger and being able to channel that energy into positive action. He said, anger is like electricity. It is just as useful and just as powerful, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So just as we channel electrical energy and bring it into our lives and use it for the good of humanity, we must learn to channel anger in the same way, so that we can use that energy for the good of humanity rather than abuse it and cause death and destruction. He suggested that I write an anger journal. He said, every time you feel angry about something, don't act on it, but write it down in your journal. But write the journal with the intention of finding a solution to the problem, and then commit yourself to finding a solution, which is very important, because today a lot of people tell me they have been writing an anger journal for a long time, but it hasn't really helped them, because every time they go back and read the journal, they're just reminded of the incident and they get angry all over again.
Uh-huh.
And that is not what we want. We don't want to be reminded of the incident. We want to be able to find a solution and put it behind us. So it's important that we learn to write the journal with the intention of finding a solution and then commit ourselves to finding that solution. I did this for many years, and I must say it helped me considerably in learning how to deal with my anger properly and efficiently.
So can you sort of give a little bit of an overview of how you would approach that in order? Because I could well imagine that most people would simply go back and read that and just be reminded and get angry all over again. So what's the key to taking that and doing something constructive with it? What did you learn about that?
Well, one of the reasons I've been going around and speaking and sharing my legacy with people all over the world is motivated by that anger. Instead of seeking revenge for the racist attacks on me and all the prejudicial attacks that I suffered, I decided to change people's hearts and minds by talking to them and transforming them. I have a very beautiful experience that I had in the 1960s, late 1960s, when I was living in Bombay. And I was forced to live in India because the South African government wouldn't allow me to bring back my Indian wife with me to South Africa. So I had to set up a home in India and abandon my mother and my sisters and be in a new country, starting life all over again. At that time, a friend of mine from South Africa wrote to me saying that he's coming to India for the first time, and he was rather nervous, and he asked me if I would meet him when his ship arrived in Bombay and make arrangements for his stay. And since he was a very good friend, I said, all right, I will do that. And when the ship came and I went to meet him, I was the first Indian to go on board the ship. And instead of meeting my friend, I first met a strange white man who came up and grabbed my hand and shook it profusely and introduced himself as Mr. Jackie Besson, a member of parliament from South Africa. The moment he told me his name, I realized who he was, and I realized that he was responsible for apartheid. He was an outspoken supporter of apartheid. And in many ways, I held him responsible for all the humiliation that I felt in South Africa. And so, the very first thought that came into my mind was to tell him and insult him and tell him to jump into the ocean, that I'm not going to do anything for you. And, just treat him as badly as I was treated in South Africa. That was my first reaction. And I immediately stopped myself because I realized that if I did that, my parents and grandparents would never forgive me. And so I reached out to him and I shook hands and introduced myself. And I told him that I am a victim of apartheid. I am forced to live here because his government wouldn't allow me to come back to South Africa with my Indian bride. But I'm not going to hold it against him. I'm going to treat him as a guest of this country, and I'm going to do my best to make his stay as pleasant as possible. And from that day, for the 5-6 days that the ship was in town, my wife and I spent every daylight hour with them, with his wife and himself, taking them around and showing them all parts of Bombay and showing them doing all the touristy things and shopping and all everything that they wanted to do. We took them around and did all that. And during that time, we also talked about apartheid. I would try to question him and find out how he could justify apartheid. And he was making a valiant attempt to justify it to me. And every time the discussion became a little uneasy, we just changed the topic and talked about other things. And I wasn't expecting that this person would be changed. But on the last day when we said our final farewell to him, he and his wife both embraced us and cried tears of remorse. I mean, tears were streaming down their cheeks, and they said, "You have to forgive us. You have opened our eyes to the evils of apartheid, and we are making this promise to you that we are going to go back to South Africa and we are going to fight apartheid." And I was still a skeptic at the time, and I wasn't willing to believe them. And I told my wife, I said, you know, these people have a habit of coming out of the country and saying one thing, and when they go back into the country, they revert back to their old methods. So let's wait and see whether they really mean this or they're just saying this to make us feel good. And we followed his political career for the next 4 or 5 years, and I must say that he was a changed person. He fought apartheid tooth and nail. He lost his election. He was kicked out of his party, but he didn't give up on fighting apartheid. And I wonder about this very often in my life. If I had submitted to the first reaction when I wanted to insult him and tell him off, would I have been able to change that person, or would I have just had that momentary satisfaction of having insulted the white man and gotten away with it? I think that's all that I would have gained from it. But by reaching out and showing him kindness and understanding and love, I was able to transform a man who was a confirmed racist. So that's the power of
Nonetheless. Absolutely. That is a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that. And it's so illustrative of exactly how one person really can make a difference. And I really appreciate that you're sharing that. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I know we have another caller who would really like to speak with you, if we can get him in. Just before we do that, I want to remind everyone that we're speaking with Mr. Arun Gandhi, and his website for his foundation is at www.gandhiforchildren.org, and Gandhi is G-A-N-D-H-I. That's gandhiforchildren.org. And in just a minute, so we can get to this last caller, I also, we're running out of time, but I wanted to mention that you have several books out, and I'm wondering if you could just quickly tell us about your books, and then we'll close with this last caller.
Well, the two books that are now available in the market here is Legacy of Love, which is a compilation of all the stories and the lessons I learned from my grandfather, and given me an understanding of his philosophy of nonviolence. And the other book is the biography of my grandmother. I realized many years ago that people had written a lot about grandfather, but they had omitted my grandmother and didn't pay much attention to her at all. So I researched her life and wrote her biography. And that is called The Forgotten Woman. And that also is available through the website, gandhiforchildren.org. And the money from both these books, sales of these books, goes to the school project and help the poor children of the world. So that's another way that your listeners can contribute to this project. Instead of making a donation, they can buy a book and still fund that program.
And the books look wonderful. All right, we are going to let Travis calling in about the Peace Corps and his experience with the Peace Corps to talk with you have the last minute. Here you go. Travis, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Travis, you are on
Hello,
the air
Travis.
With Mr. Gandhi.
Hi, thank you so much for allowing me to say something here. I've been serving with the Peace Corps for 2 years. I have 1 year that I've extended beyond the normal 2 years of service. I'm in Mongolia, and one of the things I've really noticed is a lot of people want to make change, and they see need in the community. And, people who are living very normal lives that have extraordinary dreams that want to have come true. And as a Peace Corps volunteer, one of the things I've seen that's my part of my job is helping people see what we're talking about, Mr. Gunn. I think
you're breaking up, Travis.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's a long way to Mongolia.
can
you restate your question?
Sure. So I've worked with a lot of people and helping people who are very inspired to change their communities, but they don't think that they're capable of doing that themselves. And I wanted to ask what your experience has been when you are helping people and when you're working with others and trying to inspire them and see what they're capable of, because I think that's often what a great leader can do, is help see people, what potential they have to make change themselves and do simple things in their lives to help others. So what would you say, if you're trying to help others and be a leader and share with others what they're capable of doing, what kind of things have you seen that's really helpful?
That's a great question.
Well, one thing that I did was to study the people and find out what are their potentials. Even the people who are volunteering to bring about a change, they have certain potentials and certain capacities, and we need to learn about them and project them, because, you know, very often we are motivated to change, but the person themselves don't know how they can use their own strengths and their own abilities to help that change. And so we, as the leaders of this group, we need to find or examine this and find out their strengths and make them realize those strengths and then use those strengths to help the poor people there.
Yes. I think
Travis,
that's so
thank
true.
You so much for the call. I'm sorry
thank
to cut you.
You
off, but we'll run over and thank you for your
thank
service
you,
as well.
No, thank you so much.
Mr. Gandhi, thank you again so much for joining us. This has been just a wonderful, wonderful hour, and thank you for sharing the stories and your insights, and above all, thank you for your foundation and what you're doing.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, that's Gandhi for Children. Thank you so much. Namaste.
Namaste, yeah.
And that website, again, is www.gandhiforchildren.org. And that was Mr. Arun Gandhi. He is the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. And again, just to remind you, next week we will be talking about boosting workplace morale and changing your own experience of a bad workplace. Thank you all so much for joining us.